Crowd on Shaftesbury Avenue or Broadway, after the theatres closed, have I heard the phrase, I laughed till the tears came. What do you think of Mr. Jones? The purser asked. Major Jones, I leave such questions to you and the captain. It was obvious that he had been consulted as well as I. Perhaps the fact that my name was Brown made me more sensitive to the comedy of Jones. I picked up one of the great sausages of fish skin and said, Do you ever put one of these to a proper use? The purser sighed. Alas, no, I have reached an age. Inevitably I get a crise de foie whenever my emotions are upset. The purser had admitted me to an intimacy, and now he required an intimacy in return, or perhaps the captain had demanded information on me too, and the purser saw an opportunity of providing it. He asked me, How did a man like you ever come to settle in Port-au-Prince? How did you ever become an hotelier? You don't look like an hotelier. You look like... But his imagination failed him. I laughed. He had asked the pertinent question all right, but the answer was one I preferred to keep to myself. 6. The captain honoured us the next night with his presence at dinner, and so did the chief engineer. I suppose there must always be a rivalry between captain and chief, as their responsibilities are equal. So long as the captain had taken his meals alone, the chief had done the same. Now, one at the head of the table, and the other at the foot, they sat with equality under the dubious balloons. There was an extra course in honour of our last night at sea, and with the exception of the Smiths, the passengers drank champagne. The purser was unusually restrained in the presence of his superior officers. I think he would have liked to join the first officer on the bridge in the freedom of the windy dark. The captain and chief were a little bowed under the sense of occasion, like priests serving at a major feast. Mrs. Smith sat on the captain's right and I on his left, and the mere presence of Jones precluded easy conversation. Even the menu was an added difficulty, for on this occasion the Dutch feeling for heavy meat dishes was given full rein, and Mrs. Smith's plate too often reproached us with its bareness. The Smiths, however, had carried with them from the States a number of cartons and bottles, which, like boys, always marked their places, and perhaps because they felt they had surrendered their principles in drinking something as doubtful in its ingredients as Coca-Cola, they mixed their own beverages tonight with the aid of hot water. "I understand," the captain said gloomily, "that after dinner there is to be an entertainment." "We're only a small company," the purser said, "but Major Jones and I felt that something must be done on our last night together. There is the kitchen orchestra, of course, and Mr. Baxter is going to give us something very special." I exchanged a puzzled glance with Mrs. Smith. Neither of us knew who Mr. Baxter could be. Had we a stowaway on board? I have asked Mr. Fernandez to help us in his own way, and he has gladly consented, the purser went happily on. We shall end by singing Auld Lang Syne for the sake of our Anglo-Saxon passengers. The duck went past a second time, and the Smiths, to keep us company, helped themselves from their packets and bottles.
Excuse me, Mrs. Smith, the captain said, but what is that you are drinking?
A little barmine with hot water, Mrs. Smith told him. My husband prefers yeast roll in the evening, or sometimes vicon. Barmine, he thinks, excites him. The captain gave a scared look at Mrs. Smith's plate and cut himself a wedge of duck. I said, And what are you eating, Mrs. Smith? I wanted the captain to taste the full extravagance of the situation.
I don't know why you should ask, Mr. Brown. You have seen me eat it every evening at the same hour. Slippery elm food, she explained to the captain. He put down his knife and fork, pushed away his plate, and sat with his head bowed. I thought at first that he was saying a grace, but I think, in fact, he had been overcome with a feeling of nausea. I shall finish up with some nuttolene, Mrs. Smith said, if you cannot supply yogurt. The captain cleared his throat harshly and looked away from her down the table, flinched a little at the sight of Mr. Smith, who was shoveling some dry brown grains across his plate, and fixed his eyes on harmless Mr. Fernandez, as though he might be in some way responsible. Then he announced in a duty voice, "Tomorrow afternoon we arrive, I hope, by 4 o'clock. I would advise you to be prompt at the customs, as the lights of the town generally go out around 6:30. "Why?" Mrs. Smith demanded. "It must be very inconvenient for everyone."
"For economy," the captain said. He added, "The news on the radio tonight is not good. Rebels are said to have attacked across the Dominican border. The government claims that all is quiet in Port-au-Prince, but I would advise those of you who are stopping there to keep in close touch with your consulates. I have received orders to land passengers promptly and proceed at once to Santo Domingo. I am not to delay for cargo."
"We seem to be hitting a spot of trouble, dear," Mr. Smith said from his end of the table, and he took another spoonful of what I took to be froment, a dish he had explained to me at lunch. "Not for the first time," Mrs. Smith replied with grim satisfaction. A sailor came in, bringing a message for the captain, and as he opened the door, a breeze set the French letters asway. They whined where they touched. The captain said,
"You must excuse me. My duty. I have to go now. I wish you all a convivial evening."
But I wondered whether the message had been prearranged. He was not a sociable man, and he had found Mrs. Smith hard to accept. The chief rose, too, as though he feared to leave the ship alone in the captain's hands. Now that the officers had gone, the purser became his old self again, and he egged us on to eat more and drink more. Even the Smiths, after a good deal of hesitation, "I am not a true gourmand," Mrs. Smith said, gave themselves a second helping of nuttolene. A sweet liqueur was served, which the purser explained was on the company, and the thought of a free liqueur mesmerized us all, except, of course, the Smiths, into further drinking. Even the pharmaceutical traveller, though he looked at his glass with apprehension, as though green was the colour for danger. When eventually we reached the saloon, a programme was lying on every chair. The purser said gaily, "Chins up," and began to beat his hands softly on his plump knees as the orchestra entered, led by the cook, a cadaverous young man, with cheeks flushed by the heat of stoves, wearing his chef's hat. His companions carried pots, pans, knives, spoons. A mincer was there to add a grinding note, and the chef held a toasting fork as a baton. In the program, the piece they played first was called Nocturne, and it was followed by a chanson d'amour, sung by the chef himself, sweetly and uncertainly. Automne, tendresse, feuille morte. I could catch only a few of the melancholy words between the hollow crash of spoon on pot. Mr. and Mrs. Smith sat hand in hand on the couch, the rug spread over her knees, and the traveller in pharmaceutical products leant earnestly forward, watching the thin singer. Perhaps with a professional eye, he was considering whether any of his drugs might be of use. As for Mr. Fernandez, he sat apart, every now and then writing something down in a notebook. Jones hovered behind the purser's chair, occasionally leaning down and whispering in his ear. He seemed in the throes of a private enjoyment, as if the whole affair were his own invention, and when he applauded, it was with a self-congratulatory glee. He looked at me and winked, as much as to say, "Just you wait. My imagination doesn't stop here. There are better things yet to come." I had meant to go to my cabin when the song was over, but Jones's manner awoke my curiosity. The pharmaceutical traveller had already disappeared, but I remembered it was past his usual bedtime. Jones now called the leader of the orchestra into conference. The chief drummer joined them with his big copper saucepan under his arm. I looked at my program and saw that the next item was a dramatic monologue by Mr. J. Baxter.
"That was a very interesting performance," Mr. Smith said. "Didn't you find it so, my dear?"
The pots were serving a better purpose than cooking an unfortunate duck, Mrs. Smith replied. Her passions had not been perceptibly weakened by the removal of acidity.
Very nicely sung, wasn't it, Mr. Fernandez?
Yes, said Mr. Fernandez, and sucked the end of his pencil. The pharmaceutical traveller entered wearing a steel helmet. He had not gone to bed, but had changed into a pair of blue jeans, and had a whistle clenched between his teeth.
"So that's Mr. Baxter," Mrs. Smith said in a tone of relief.
I think she disliked mysteries. She wanted all ingredients of the human comedy marked as precisely as one of Mr. Baxter's drugs or the label on the bottle of barmine. The pharmaceutical traveller could easily have borrowed the blue jeans from a member of the crew, but I wondered how he had obtained his steel helmet. Now he gave a blast of his whistle to silence us, though only Mrs. Smith had spoken, and announced, "A dramatic monologue entitled The Warden's Patrol." To his obvious dismay, a member of the orchestra reproduced an air raid siren.
"Bravo," Jones said.
"You should have warned me," Mr. Baxter said. "Now I'm off my cue."
He was interrupted again by a roll of distant gunfire produced on the bottom of a frying pan.
"What's that supposed to be?" Mr. Baxter demanded angrily. "The guns in the estuary."
"You are interfering with my script, Mr. Jones."
"Proceed," Jones said. "The overture is over. The atmosphere is set. London, 1940.
Mr. Baxter gave him a sad, hurt look and announced again,
"A dramatic monologue entitled The Warden's Patrol, composed by Post-Warden X."
Holding his palm over his eyes, as though to ward off falling glass, he began to recite,
"The flares came down over Euston, St. Pancras, and dear old Tottenham Road, and the warden, walking his lonely beat, saw his shadow like a cloud. Guns in Hyde Park were blasting away when the cry of the first bomb came, and the warden shook his fist at the sky as he mocked at Hitler's fame. London will stand, St. Paul's will stand, and for every death we have here, a curse will arise from a German art against their devilish Führer. Maples is it, Gower Street's a ghost, Piccadilly's a light, but all's well. We'll use our ration of bread for toast, for the Blitzkrieg's dead in Pall Mall."
Mr. Baxter gave a blast on his whistle, came sharply to attention, and said,
"The all clear has sounded." "And none too soon," Mrs. Smith replied.
Mr. Fernandez cried excitedly,
"No, no, oh, no, sir."
And I think with the exception of Mrs. Smith, there was general agreement that anything coming afterwards would be in the nature of an anticlimax.
"That calls for more champagne," Jones said. "Steward!"
The orchestra went back to the kitchen, except for the conductor, who stayed at Jones's request.
"The champagne's on me," Jones said. "You deserve a glass if any man did."
Mr. Baxter sat down suddenly beside me and began to tremble all over. His hand beat nervously on the table.
"Don't mind me," he said. "It's always been this way. I get my stage fright afterwards." "Would you say that I was well received?"
"Very," I said. "Where did you find the steel helmet?"
"It's just one of those things I carry around in the bottom of my trunk. Somehow I've never parted with it. I expect it's the same with you. There are things you keep."
It was true enough. There were more portable objects than a steel helmet, but they were just as useless. Photographs, an old postcard, a membership receipt long out of date for a nightclub off Regent Street, an entrance ticket for one day to the casino at Monte Carlo. I was sure I could find half a dozen such if I turned out my pocketbook.
"The blue jeans are borrowed from the second officer, but they have a foreign cut."
"Let me pour you out a glass. Your hand is still trembling."
"You really like the poem?"
"It was very vivid."
Then I'll tell you what I've never told anyone before. I was post-Warden X. I wrote it myself, after the May Blitz in 41.
Have you written much else? I asked.
Nothing, sir. Oh, except once, about the funeral of a child.
And now, gentlemen, the purser announced, if you will look at our program, you will see that we have come to a very special turn promised us by Mr. Fernandez. A very special turn it proved to be, for Mr. Fernandez broke as suddenly into tears as Mr. Baxter had broken into the trembles. Had he drunk too much champagne, or had he been moved genuinely by Mr. Baxter's recitation? I doubted that, for he seemed to have no words of English except his yes and no. But now he wept, sitting straight upright in his chair. He wept with great dignity, and I thought, I have never seen a colored man weep before. I had seen them laughing, angry, frightened, but never overcome like this man with inexplicable grief. We sat silent and watched him. There was nothing any of us could do. We couldn't communicate. His body shook slightly, just as the saloon shook with the vibration of the ship's engines, and I thought that this, after all, was a more suitable way than music and songs to approach the Dark Republic. There was plenty for all of us to weep for where we were going. Then I saw the Smiths for the first time at their best. I had disliked the quick rap Mrs. Smith had given poor Baxter. I suppose that any poem about war was offensive to her. But she was the only one of us now to move to Mr. Fernandez's help. She sat down beside him, saying not a word, and took his hand in hers. With the other she stroked his pink palm. She might have been a mother comforting her child among strangers. Mr. Smith followed her and sat down on Mr. Fernandez's other side, so that they formed a little group apart. Mrs. Smith made small clucking noises, as she might have done to her child, and as suddenly as he had begun, Mr. Fernandez ceased to weep. He stood up, lifted Mrs. Smith's old horny hand to his lips, and strode out of the saloon.
"Well," Baxter exclaimed, "what on earth do you suppose?"
"Very strange," the purser said. "Very strange indeed."
"A bit of a damper," Jones said.
He held up the champagne bottle, but it was empty, and he put it down again. The conductor picked up his toasting fork and returned to the kitchen.
"The poor man has troubles," Mrs. Smith said. It was all the explanation needed, and she looked at her hand as though she expected to see on the skin the impress of Mr. Fernandez's full lips.
"A real damper," Jones repeated. Mr. Smith said, "If I may make a suggestion, perhaps we should bring the entertainment to a close now with Auld Lang Syne. Midnight is not far off. I wouldn't like Mr. Fernandez all alone down there to think that we continued skylarking."
It was hardly the word I would have used to describe our celebrations so far, but I agreed with the principal. We had no orchestra now to accompany us, but Mr. Jones sat down at the piano and picked out a fair rendering of the awful tune. Rather self-consciously we joined hands and sang. Without the cook and Jones and Mr. Fernandez, we made a very small circle. We had hardly yet experienced old acquaintance, and yet our cups were already exhausted.
7. It was well after midnight when Jones rapped on my cabin door. I was going through some papers with the idea of destroying anything which might be unfavorably interpreted by the authorities. For instance, there had been an exchange of letters concerning the possible sale of my hotel, and in some of them there were dangerous references to the political situation. I was sunk in my thoughts, and I responded nervously to his knock, as though I were already back in the Republic, and a Tonton Macoute might be at the door.
"I'm not keeping you awake?" he asked.
"I haven't started undressing."
"I was sorry about tonight. It didn't go as well as I wished. Of course, the material was limited. You know I have a kind of thing about a last night on board. One may never see each other again. It's like New Year's Eve when you want the old codger to go out well. Isn't there something they call a good death? I didn't like that black fellow crying that way. It was as though he saw things. In the future, course, I'm not a religious man. He looked at me shrewdly. You neither, I would say. I had the impression he had come to my cabin for a purpose, not merely to express his disappointment at the entertainment, but perhaps to make a request or to ask a question. If he had been in a position to threaten me, I would even have suspected he had come for that. He wore his ambiguity like a loud suit, and he seemed proud of it, like a man who says, "You must take me as you find me." He continued, "The purser says you really own that hotel." "Did you doubt it?" "Not exactly, but you didn't seem the type. We don't always put the right descriptions on our passports," he explained in a tone sweetly reasonable. "What have you got on yours?" "Company director, and that's quite true, in a way," he admitted. "Anyway, it's vague enough," I said. "And what's on yours?" "Businessman." "That's even vaguer," he exclaimed triumphantly. Interrogation, partly concealed, was to be the basis of our relationship in the short time it lasted. We would snatch at small clues, though in great matters we would usually pretend to accept the other's story. I suppose those of us who spend a large part of our lives in dissembling, whether to a woman, to a partner, even to our own selves, begin to smell each other out. Jones and I learnt a lot about one another before the end, for one uses a little truth whenever one can. It is a form of economy. He had said, "You've lived in Port-au-Prince. You must know some of the big boys there." "They come and go." "In the army, for example?" "They've all gone. Papa Doc doesn't trust the army. The chief of staff, I believe, is hiding in the Venezuelan embassy. The general's safe in Santo Domingo. There are some colonels left in the Dominican embassy, and there are 3 colonels and 2 majors in prison, if they are alive. Did you have introductions to any of them?" "Not exactly," he said, but he looked uneasy. "It is well not to present introductions till you are sure your man is still alive. I have a chit from the Haitian Consul General in New York recommending me." "We've been at sea 3 days, remember. A lot can happen in that time. The Consul General may have sought asylum." He said, as the purser had done, "I wonder what brings you back, conditions being what they are." The truth was less fatiguing than invention, and the hour was late. "I found I missed the place," I said. "Security can get on the nerves just as much as danger." He said, "Yes, I thought I had had my fill of danger in the war." "What unit were you in?" He grinned at me. I had played a card too obviously. "Oh, I was a bit of a drifter even in those days," he said. "I moved around. Tell me, what kind of a chap's our ambassador?" "We haven't got one. He was expelled more than a year ago." "The chargé, then?" "He does what he can, when he can." "We seem to be sailing towards a strange country." He went to the porthole as though he expected to be able to see the land across the last 200 miles of sea, but there was nothing to be observed except the light of the cabin lying on the surface of the dark swell like yellow oil. "Not exactly a tourist paradise any longer?" "No, it never really was. But perhaps a few opportunities for a man of imagination?" "It depends." "On what?" "The kind of scruples you have." "Scruples?" He looked out onto the rolling night, and he seemed to be weighing the question with some care. "Oh, well, scruples cost a lot." "Why did you suppose that nigger really wept?" "I've no idea." "It was an odd evening. I hope we do better next time." "Next time?" "I was thinking of when this year ends, wherever we may be. He came away from the porthole and said, "Oh, well, it's time for shut-eye, isn't it? And, Smith, what do you suppose he's up to?"
"Why should he be up to anything?"
"You may be right. Don't mind me, I'm going now. The trip's over. No getting out of it now." He added, with his hand on the door, "I tried to cheer things up, but it wasn't much of a success. Shut-eye's the answer to it all, isn't it? Or that's how I see it."
Chapter 2. I was returning without much hope to a country of fear and frustration, and yet every familiar feature as the Medea drew in gave me a kind of happiness. The huge mass of Kenskoff leaning over the town was, as usual, half in deep shadow. There was a glassy sparkle of late sun off the new buildings near the port, which had been built for an international exhibition in so-called modern style. A stone Columbus watched us coming in. It was there Martha and I used to rendezvous at night until the curfew closed us in separate prisons, I in my hotel, she in her embassy, without even a telephone which worked to communicate by. She would sit in her husband's car in the dark and flash her headlights on at the sound of my humbug. I wondered whether in the last month, now that the curfew was over, she had chosen a different rendezvous, and I wondered with whom. That she had found a substitute, I had no doubt. No one banks on fidelity nowadays. I was lost in too many difficult thoughts to remember my fellow passengers. There was no message waiting for me from the British Embassy, so I assumed that at the moment all was well. At Immigration and Customs there was the habitual confusion. We were the only boat, and yet the shed was full. Porters, taxi drivers, who hadn't had a fare in weeks, police, and the occasional Tonton Macoute in his black glasses and his soft hat. And beggars, beggars everywhere. They seeped through every chink, like water in the rainy season. A man without legs sat under the customs counter like a rabbit in a hutch, miming in silence. A familiar figure forced his way towards me. As a rule, he haunted the airfield, and I had not expected to see him here. He was a journalist, known to everyone as Petit Pierre, a métis in a country where the half-castes are the aristocrats waiting for the tumbrils to roll. He was believed by some to have connections with the Tonton, for how otherwise had he escaped a beating up or worse? And yet there were occasionally passages in his gossip column that showed an odd satirical courage. Perhaps he depended on the police not to read between the lines. He seized me by the hands as if we were the oldest of friends and addressed me in English.
"Why, Mr. Brown, Mr. Brown!"
"How are you, Petit Pierre?" He giggled up at me, standing on his pointed toe-caps, for he was a tiny figure of a man. He was just as I had remembered him, hilarious. Even the time of day was humorous to him. He had the quick movements of a monkey, and he seemed to swing from wall to wall on ropes of laughter. I had always thought that when the time came, and surely it must one day come in his precarious, defiant livelihood, he would laugh at his executioner, as a Chinaman is supposed to do.
"It's good to see you, Mr. Brown. How are the bright lights of Broadway? Marilyn Monroe, lots of good bourbon, speakeasies?"
He was a little out of date, for he had not been further than Kingston, Jamaica, in 30 years.
"Give me your passport, Mr. Brown. Where are your luggage tickets?"
He waved them above his head, pushing through the mob, arranging everything, for he knew everyone. Even the customs man allowed my baggage to pass unopened. He exchanged some words with a Tonton Macoute at the door, and by the time I emerged he had found me a taxi.
Sit down, Mr. Brown. Your luggage is just coming."
"How are things here?" I asked.
"All as usual. All quiet."
"No curfew?"
"Why should there be a curfew, Mr. Brown?"
"The papers reported rebels in the north."
"The papers? American papers? You don't believe what the American papers say, do you?"
He leant his head in at the taxi door and said with his odd hilarity,
You can't think how happy I am, Mr. Brown, to see you back.
I almost believed him.
Why not? Don't I belong here?
Of course you belong here, Mr. Brown. You are a true friend of Haiti.
He giggled again.
All the same, many true friends have left us recently.
He lowered his voice just a tone.
The government has been forced to take over some empty hotels.
Thanks for the warning.
It would have been wrong to let the properties deteriorate.
A kindly thought. Who lives in them now?
He giggled.
Guests of the government?
Do they run to guests now?
There was a Polish mission, but they went away rather soon.
Here comes your luggage, Mr. Brown.
Shall I get to the Trianon before the lights go out?
Yes, if you go direct.
Where else should I go?
Petit Pierre chuckled and said,
Let me come with you, Mr. Brown. There are roadblocks now between Port-au-Prince and Pétionville.
All right, get in.
Anything to avoid trouble, I said.
What were you doing in New York, Mr. Brown?
I replied truthfully. I was trying to find someone to buy my hotel.
You had no luck?
No luck at all.
No enterprise in such a great country?
You expelled their military mission. You had the ambassador recalled. You can't expect much confidence there, can you?
My God, I completely forgot. There's a presidential candidate on board the boat.
A presidential candidate? I should have been warned.
Not a very successful one.
All the same, a presidential candidate. What does he come here for?
He has an introduction to the Secretary for Social Welfare.
Dr. Filippo? But Dr. Filippo?
Anything wrong?
You know what politics are. It's the same in all countries.
Dr. Philippot is out.
He has not been seen for a week. He is said to be on holiday.
Petit Pierre touched the taxi driver's shoulder.
Stop, mon ami.
We hadn't got as far yet as the Columbus statue, and the dark was rapidly falling. He said,
Mr. Brown, I think that I had better go back and find him. You know how it is in your own country. One must avoid giving a false impression. It would not do for me to come to England carrying an introduction to Mr. Macmillan.
He waved to me as he went away.
I will come up presently for a whiskey. I am so glad to see you back, Mr. Brown.
And he departed with that air of euphoria based on nothing at all. We drove on. I asked the driver, he was probably a Tonton agent,
Shall we get to the Trianon before the lights go out?
He shrugged his shoulders. It was not his job to give away information. The lights were still burning in the exhibition building used by the Secretary of State, and there was a Peugeot parked by the Columbus statue. Of course, there were a lot of Peugeots in Port-au-Prince, and I couldn't believe that she would be cruel enough, or tasteless enough, to choose the same rendezvous. All the same, I said to the driver,
I'll get out here. Take my luggage up to the Trianon. Joseph will pay you.
I could hardly have been less prudent. The colonel in charge of the Tonton Macoute would certainly know next morning exactly where I had left the taxi. The only precaution I took was to see that the man really drove away. I watched the taillights until they were out of sight. Then I made my way towards Columbus and the parked car. I came up behind it and saw the CD number plate. It was Martha's car, and she was alone. I watched her for a little while without being seen. It occurred to me that I could wait there, a few yards away, until I saw the man who came to meet her. Then she turned her head and stared in my direction. She knew that someone was watching her. She lowered the window half an inch and said sharply in French, as though I might be one of the innumerable beggars of the port,
Who are you? What do you want?
Then she turned on her headlights.
Oh, God, she said, so you've come back,
in the kind of tone she might have used for a recurrent fever. She opened the door and I got in beside her.
I could feel uncertainty and fear in her kiss.
"Why have you come back?" she asked.
"I suppose I missed you."
"Did you have to run away to discover that?"
"I hoped that things might change if I went away."
"Nothing has changed."
"What are you doing here?"
"It's a better place than most to miss you in."
"You weren't waiting for anyone?"
"No."
She took one of my fingers and twisted it till it hurt.
"I can be sage, you know, for a few months, except in dreams. I've been unfaithful in dreams."
"I've been faithful, too, in my way."
"You needn't tell me now," she said, "what your way is. Just be quiet. Be here."
I obeyed her. I was half happy, half miserable, because it was only too evident one thing hadn't changed, except that now, without my car, she would have to drive me back and run the risk of being seen near the Trianon. We wouldn't say good night beside Columbus. Even while I made love to her, I tested her. Surely she wouldn't have the nerve to take me if she were expecting another man at the rendezvous. And then I told myself that it wasn't a fair test. She had nerve for anything. It was no lack of nerve that tied her to her husband. She gave a cry which I remembered and stuck her hand over her mouth. Her body lost its tenseness. She was like a tired child resting on my knees. She said,
"I forgot to close the window."
"We'd better get up to the Trianon before the lights go out."
"Have you found someone to buy the place?"
"No."
"I'm glad."
In the public park, the musical fountain stood black, waterless, unplaying. Electric globes winked out the nocturnal message, "Je suis le drapeau haïtien, uni et indivisible, François Duvalier." We passed the blackened beams of the house the Tonton had destroyed and mounted the hill towards Pétionville. Halfway up, there was a roadblock. A man in a torn shirt and a grey pair of trousers and an old soft hat, which someone must have discarded in a dustbin, came trailing his rifle by its muzzle to the door. He told us to get out and be searched.
"I'll get out," I said, "but this lady belongs to the diplomatic corps." "Darling, don't make a fuss," she said. "There are no such things as privileges now."
She led the way to the roadside, putting her hands above her head and giving the militiaman a smile I hated. I said to him, "Don't you see the CD on the car?"
"And can't you see," she said, "that he can't read?"
He felt my hips and ran his hands up between my legs. Then he opened the boot of the car. It was not a very practiced search, and it was soon over. He cleared a passage through the barrier and let us go by. "I don't like you driving back alone," I said. "I'll lend you a boy, if I've got one left." And then, after I had driven half a mile further, I went back in my mind to the old suspicion. If a husband is notoriously blind to infidelity, I suppose a lover has the opposite fault. He sees it everywhere. "Tell me what you were really doing waiting by the statue."
"Don't be a fool tonight," she said. "I'm happy."
"I never wrote to you that I was coming back."
"It was a place to remember you in, that was all."
"It seems a coincidence that just tonight—"
"Do you suppose this was the only night I bothered to remember you?"
She added,
"Louise asked me once why I had stopped going out in the evening for gin rummy, now the curfew had lifted. So next night I took the car as usual. I had no one to see and nothing to do, so I drove to the statue."
"And Luis is content?"
"He's always content."
Suddenly around us, above us, and below us, the lights went out. Only a glow remained around the harbour and the government buildings. "I hope Joseph has kept a bit of oil for my return," I said. "I hope he's wise as well as virgin."
"Is he virgin?"
"Well, he's chaste, since the Tonton Macoute kicked him around."
We entered the steep drive lined with palm trees and bougainvillea. I always wondered why the original owner had called the hotel the Trianon. No name could have been less suitable. The architecture of the hotel was neither classical in the 18th century manner nor luxurious in the 20th century fashion. With its towers and balconies and wooden fretwork decorations, it had the air at night of a Charles Adams house in a number of the New Yorker. You expected a witch to open the door to you, or a maniac butler with a bat dangling from the chandelier behind him. But in the sunlight, or when the lights went on among the palms, it seemed fragile and period and pretty and absurd, an illustration from a book of fairy tales. I had grown to love the place, and I was glad in a way that I had found no purchaser. I believed that if I could own it for a few more years, I would feel I had a home. Time was needed for a home, as time was needed to turn a mistress into a wife. Even the violent death of my partner had not seriously disturbed my possessive love. I would have remarked, with Frère Laurent, in the French version of Romeo and Juliet, a sentence that I had reason to remember. Le remède au chaos n'est pas dans ce chaos. The remedy had been in the success, which owed nothing to my partner, in the voices calling from the bathing pool, in the rattle of ice from the bar, where Joseph made his famous rum punches, in the arrival of taxis from the town, in the hubbub of lunch on the veranda, and at night the drummer and the dancers, with Baron Samedi, a grotesque figure in a ballet, stepping it delicately in his top hat under the lighted palms. I had known for a short time all of this. We drew up in the darkness, and I kissed Martha again. It was still an interrogation. I could not believe in a fidelity that lasted for 3 months of solitude. Perhaps it was a less disagreeable speculation than another. She had turned to her husband again. I held her against me and said, "How is Louise?"
"The same," she said, "always the same."
And yet I thought she must have loved him once. This is one of the pains of illicit love. Even your mistress's most extreme embrace is a proof the more that love doesn't last. I had met Louise for the second time when I was among the 30 guests at an embassy cocktail party. It seemed to me impossible that the ambassador, that stout man in the late 40s, whose hair gleamed like a polished shoe, did not remark how often our eyes met across the crowded room, the surreptitious touch she gave me with her hand as we passed. But Louise kept his appearance of established superiority. This was his embassy, this was his wife, these were his guests. The books of matches were stamped with his initials, even the bands round his cigars. I remember him raising a cocktail glass to the light and showing me the delicate engraving of a bull's mask. He said, "I had them specially designed for me in Paris." He had a great sense of possession, but perhaps he didn't mind lending what he possessed. "Has Louise comforted you while I was away?"
"No,"
she said, and I cursed myself for my cowardice in so phrasing the question that her answer remained ambiguous. She added, "No one has comforted me," and at once I began to think of all the meanings of comfort from which she might choose one to satisfy her sense of truth, for she had a sense of truth. "You've got a different scent."
"Louise gave me this for my birthday. I'd finished yours."
"Your birthday? I forgot."
"It doesn't matter."
"Joseph is a long time," I said. "He must have heard the car."
She said, "Louise is kind to me. You are the only one who kicks me around, like the Tonton Macoute with Joseph."
"What do you mean?" Everything was just as before. After 10 minutes we had made love, and after half an hour we had begun to quarrel. I left the car and walked up the steps in the dark. At the top I nearly stumbled on my suitcases, which the driver must have deposited there, and I called, "Joseph! Joseph!" And no one replied. The veranda stretched on either side of me, but no table was laid for dinner. Through the open door of the hotel I could see the bar
by the light of a tiny oil lamp, like the ones you placed beside a child's bed or the bed of someone sick. This was my luxury hotel, a circle of light which barely touched a half-empty bottle of rum, two stools, a siphon of soda crouched in the shadow like a bird with a long beak. I called again, "Joseph! Joseph!" and again nobody answered. I went back down the steps to the car and said to Martha, "Stay a moment. Is something wrong? I can't find Joseph. I ought to be getting back." "You can't go alone. Don't be in such a hurry. Louise can wait a moment." I mounted the steps again to the Hotel Trianon. A center of Haitian intellectual life, a luxury hotel which caters equally for the connoisseur of good food and the lover of local customs. Try the special drinks made from the finest Haitian rum, bathe in the luxurious swimming pool, listen to the music of the Haitian drum, and watch the Haitian dances. Mingle with the elite of Haitian intellectual life, the musicians, the poets, the painters, who find at the Hotel Trianon a social center. The tourist brochure had been nearly true once. I felt under the bar and found an electric torch. I went through the lounge to my office, the desk covered with old bills and receipts. I had not expected a client, but even Joseph was not there. What a homecoming, I thought. What a homecoming. Below the office was the bathing pool. About this hour, the cocktail guests should have been arriving from other hotels in the town. Few in the good days drank anywhere else but the Trianon, except for those who were booked on round tours and chalked everything up. The Americans always drank dry martinis. By midnight, some of them would be swimming around in the pool, naked. Once I had looked out of my window at 2 in the morning. There was a great yellow moon, and a girl was making love in the pool. She had her breasts pressed against the side, and I couldn't see the man behind her. She didn't notice me watching her. She didn't notice anything. That night, I thought before I slept, I have arrived. I heard steps in the garden coming up from the direction of the swimming pool, the broken steps of a man limping. Joseph had always limped since his encounter with the Tonton Macoute. I was about to go out onto the veranda to meet him when I looked again at my desk. There was something missing. All the bills were there, which had accumulated in my absence, but where was the small brass paperweight, shaped like a coffin, marked with the letters R.I.P., that I bought for myself one Christmas in Miami? It had no value. It had cost me $2.75, but it was mine, and it amused me, and it was no longer there. Why should things change in our absence? Even Martha had changed her scent. The more unstable life is, the less one likes the small details to alter. I went out onto the veranda to meet Joseph. I could see his light as it corkscrewed along the curving path from the pool. "Is it you, Monsieur Brown?" he called up nervously. "Of course it's me. Why weren't you here when I arrived? Why have you left my suitcases?" He stood below me, looking up with a sick expression on his black face. "Madame Pineda gave me a lift. I want you to drive back with her into the town. You can return on the bus. Is the gardener here?" "He go away." "The cook?" "He go away." "My paperweight. What's happened to my paperweight?" He looked at me as though he didn't understand. "Have there been no guests at all since I left?" "No, monsieur, only..." "Only what?" "4 nights ago, Dr. Philipot, he come here. He say, tell nobody." "What did he want?" "I tell him he no stay here. I tell him the Tonton Macoute look for him here." "What did he do?" "He stay, all the same. Then the cook go away and the gardener go away. They say they come back when he go. He very sick man. That's why he stay. I say go to the mountain, but he say no walk, no walk. His feet, they swell bad. I tell him he go before you come back." "It's the hell of a mess for me to come back to," I said. "I'll talk to him. Which room is he in?" "When I hear the car,
I called to him, "Tonton, get out quick." He very tired. He not want to go. He say, "I old man." I tell him, "Monsieur Brown, he ruined if they find you here along." "All same for you," I say, "if Tonton find you in the road. But Monsieur Brown, he ruined if they catch you here." I tell him I go and talk to them. He go out then quick, quick, but it was only that stupid taxi man with the luggage. So I run to tell him.
What are we going to do with him, Joseph? Dr. Philippot was not a bad man as government officials go. He had even, during his first year of office, made some attempt to improve the conditions of the shanty town along the waterfront. They had built a water pump, with his name on a stamped cast-iron label, at the bottom of the Rue de Sey, but the pipes had never been connected because the contractors had not received a proper rake-off.
"When I go in his room, he not there any more."
"Do you think he's made for the mountain?"
"No, Monsieur Brown, not the mountain," Joseph said.
He stood below me with his head bowed.
"I think he gone done a very wicked thing," he added in a low voice, the inscription on my paperweight. "Requiescat in pace," for Joseph was a good Catholic as well as a good voodooist. "Please, Monsieur Brown, come with me."
I followed him down the path to the bathing pool, in which I had seen the pretty girl making love once in another epoch, in the Golden Age. It was empty of water now. My torch lit the shallows and a litter of leaves.
"Other end," Joseph told me, standing quite still, not going any nearer.
Dr. Philippot must have walked up to the narrow cave of shadow made by the diving plank, and now he lay in a crouched position below it, with his knees drawn towards his chin, a middle-aged fetus ready-dressed for burial in his neat grey suit. He had cut his wrists first and then his throat to make sure. Above the head was the dark circle of the pipe. We had only to turn on the water to wash the blood away. He had been as considerate as possible. He could not have been dead for more than a few minutes. My first thoughts were selfish ones. You cannot be blamed if a man kills himself in your swimming pool. There was easy access to it, direct from the road, without passing the house. Beggars used to come here to try to sell trumpery wooden carvings to the guests swimming in the pool. I asked Joseph, "Is Dr. Maggio still in town?" He nodded. "Go to Madame Pineda in the car outside and ask her to drive you to his house on the way to the embassy. Don't tell her the reason. Bring him back, if he'll come." He was the only doctor in town, I thought, with the courage to attend even a stone-dead enemy of the Baron. But before Joseph could start up the path, there was a clatter of footsteps, and I heard the unmistakable voice of Mrs. Smith. "The New York customs could learn a thing or two from the men here. They were very polite to us both. You never find such courtesy among white people as you do with colored."
"Look out, my dear, there's a hole in the path."
"I can see well enough. There's nothing like raw carrots for the sight, Mrs. Pineda. Mrs. Pineda." Martha brought up the rear, carrying an electric torch. Mr. Smith said,
"We found this good lady in the car outside. There seemed no one around."
"I'm sorry. I'd quite forgotten you were going to stay here."
"I thought Mr. Jones was coming here, too, but we left him with a police officer. I hope he's not in trouble."
"Joseph, get the John Barrymore suite ready. See that there are plenty of lamps for Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I must apologize for the lights. They will come on any moment now."
"We like it," Mr. Smith said. "It feels like an adventure."
If a spirit hovers, as some believe, for an hour or two over the cadaver it has abandoned, what banalities it is doomed to hear, while it waits in a despairing hope that some serious thought will be uttered, some expression which will lend dignity to the life it has left. I said to Mrs. Smith, "Tonight, would you mind having only eggs? Tomorrow I'll have everything organized to suit you. Unfortunately, the cook went off yesterday."
"Don't bother about the eggs," Mr. Smith said. "To tell you the truth, we are a little dogmatic about eggs, but we've got our own yeast roll."
And I have my barmine, Mrs. Smith said.
Just a little hot water, Mr. Smith said. Mrs. Smith and I are very mobile. You don't have to worry about us. You've got a fine pool here.
To show them the extent of the pool, Martha began to move the ray of her lamp towards the diving board and the deep end. I took it quickly from her and turned it up towards the fretted tower and a balcony which leant over the palms. A light already glowed up there where Joseph was preparing the room.
There's your suite, I said, the John Barrymore suite. You can see all over Port-au-Prince from there, the harbour, the palace, the cathedral.
Did John Barrymore really stay here? Mr. Smith asked. In that room?
It was before my time, but I can show you his liquor bills.
A great talent ruined, he remarked sadly.
I couldn't forget that presently the light rationing would be over, and the lamps would go on all over Port-au-Prince. Sometimes the light was out for close on 3 hours, sometimes for less than one. There was no certainty. I had told Joseph that during my absence business was to be as usual, for who could tell whether a couple of journalists might not stop for a few days to write a report on what they would undoubtedly call the Nightmare Republic. Perhaps for Joseph, business as usual meant lights as usual in the palm trees, lights around the pool. I didn't want the presidential candidate to see a corpse coiled up under the diving board, not on his first night. It was not my idea of hospitality. And hadn't he said something about a letter of introduction he carried to the Secretary for Social Welfare? Joseph appeared at the head of the path. I told him to show the Smiths to their room, and afterwards to drive downtown with Mrs. Pineda.
Our luggage is on the veranda, Mrs. Smith said.
You'll find it in your room by now. It won't stay dark much longer, I promise. You must excuse us. We are a very poor country.
When I think of all that waste on Broadway, Mrs. Smith said, and to my relief they began to mount the path, Joseph lighting the way. I stayed at the shallow end of the pool, but now that my eyes were accustomed to the dark, I thought I could detect the body like a hump of earth.
Martha said, "Is something wrong?" and flashed her light up towards my face.
"I haven't had time to see yet. Lend me that torch a moment."
"What was keeping you down here?"
I let the torch play on the palm trees well away from the pool, as though I were inspecting the light installations.
"Talking to Joseph, let's go up now, shall we?"
"And run into the Smiths? I'd rather stay here. It's funny to think I've never been here before, in your home."
"No, we've always been very prudent."
"You haven't asked after Angel."
"I'm sorry."
Angel was her son, the unbearable child who helped to keep us apart. He was too fat for his age. He had his father's eyes, like brown buttons. He sucked bonbons. He noticed things. And he made claims. Claims all the time on his mother's exclusive attention.
He seemed to draw the tenderness out of our relationship as he drew the liquid center from a sweet with a long, sucking breath.
He was the subject of half our conversations.
"I must go now. I promised Angel to read to him."
"I can't see you tonight. Angel wants to go to the cinema. My darling, I'm so tired this evening. Angel had 6 friends to tea."
"How is Angel?"
"He was ill while you were away, with the grippe."
"But he's quite better now?"
"Oh, yes, he's better."
"Let's go."
"Luis doesn't expect me as early as this, nor Angel. I'm here. We may as well be hanged for a sheep."
I looked at the dial of my watch. It was nearly 8:30. I said, "The Smiths?"
"They are busy with their luggage."
"What's worrying you, darling?" I said feebly.
"I've lost a paperweight."
"A very precious paperweight?"
"No.
But if a paperweight's gone, what else has gone?"
Suddenly, all around us, the lights flashed on. I took her arm and wrenched her round and moved her up the path.
Mr. Smith came out onto his balcony and called to us. "Do you think Mrs. Smith could have another blanket on the bed, just in case it turns chilly? I'll have one sent up, but it won't turn chilly." "It certainly is a fine view from up here."
"I'll turn up the lights in the garden, and then you'll see better."
The controlling switch was in my office, and we had almost reached it when Mr. Smith's voice came again. "Mr. Brown, there's someone asleep in your pool."
"I expect it's a beggar."
Mrs. Smith must have joined him, for it was her voice I heard now.
"Where, dear?"
"Down there."
"The poor man. I've a good mind to take him down some money."
I was tempted to call up, "Take him your letter of introduction. It's the Secretary for Social Welfare."
"I wouldn't do that, dear. You'll only wake the poor fellow up."